may remember, his most recent lectures, which were about 2 or 3 years ago, were in Afghanistan. And I actually remember how difficult it was now, how difficult it was to get hold of John, because he was back and forth between here and Afghanistan. Let me just tell you a bit about him. He holds qualifications from the University of the Witwatersrand for the year degree, and completed a one-year fellowship as a William Benton Fellow in Broadcast Journalism at the University of Chicago. In his career as a political journalist, he has worked at several South African newspapers, including the Rand Daily Mail, the Sunday Times, and the Sunday Times, where he was the editorial bureau chief. I'm not listing them all, they're many. He worked in the United States from 1980 to 1986 as a correspondent for several South African newspapers and as editor of the Washington Report. Born back in South Africa, he continued to work as a journalist, as parliamentary correspondent and columnist and editor-in-chief of This Day. Most recently, he was councillor for the Independent Broadcasting Authority and worked in Afghanistan as chairperson of the Electoral Media Commission, as an advisor and as an acting project coordinator. He's currently writing books and lecturing and working as a journalist for a number of South African and international publications. And because he has worked at virtually every broadcaster and newspaper in the country, he is referred to as South Africa's Kevin Bacon. Please welcome John Matheson.
His income is just a shade higher than mine. Thanks very much. Could I just ask, because I'm going to be talking about South African media, how many of you are either South African or spend a lot of time here, so we don't have to sort of tell the basics? Okay, good, most of you. Thank you very much. I started this project, which was the picture you saw before, is the draft cover of the newspaper, of the book I'm writing. I started it partly because of the secrecy bill and the other pressures on the press now, and also because I had an insight from periods I was involved in into things that were never made public before, and I thought very interesting and needed to be said and put into a context. And as I went on, I started to read some of the history and found there's some extraordinary new research that's being done. And so I've... Are we not hearing anything? Is that better? No? Not working.
Every time you close it works. Can you hold it? It's going to be too much.
Well, does it work like that?
Yes.
Okay. If it doesn't, please. So there's so much interesting that's been being researched now on some of the earlier periods that was never known, and of course the kind of history we got taught at school and the media we were subjected to as in our lives here has distorted and censored a lot of information, and of course also no, not working. Is that better? No.
We're going to, if you can continue just for a
moment,
we're going to bring you a handheld mic.
Okay. Okay,
I'm sorry about that. We've got a brand new lecture
theatre
equipment and it's clearly
yes,
too sensitive.
Apparently the lecture
theatre has
just been redone.
It's completely redone and it was redone finished last week, and they're just very sensitive now.
Maybe you'll understand how President Obama feels with healthcare.gov.
Thanks. Can you manage without someone?
Oh, well, can you hear me?
You can just do the best you can until they come back.
All right,
back.
Okay.
Just run.
Okay. All right.
Sorry
cool.
about that.
We'll make it work. Okay. So, one of the questions I was also interested in is what influence does the press have? I remember when I was on the Sunday Times, Joel Mervis, who was the great editor who built the Sunday Times, in his farewell speech, he listed his accomplishments under various headlines. And the first headline was Power and Influence. And it was the most powerful paper in the country at the time, the Sunday Times, being in circulation and so on. And under power and influence, he said, when I took over, I decided to support the United Party, and the United Party lost 20 seats that year, so I accelerated my support. And as he accelerated his support, the party declined to live. So I think it's all, and if, you know, so he never influenced, a paper as powerful as the Sunday Times never influenced voters. And likewise, the SABC was the dominant source of news and information for black South Africans, but it was always clear that they would have voted ANC if there was an election in the 50s, in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, or the 90s, as they duly did. So the press doesn't have that kind of direct influence in terms of voting, but it still has a very important influence, and I wanted to look at that, and that's why the title of the book talks about the war of ideas, because in South Africa, at least, it did very much become a war of ideas. Now, I want to go to the start. This, just as a titillating slide before we get into the meat of it, these were three newspaper editors and founders of newspapers operating at the same time in South Africa in the 19-teens. Mahatma Gandhi was running a really influential South African newspaper called Indian Opinion. D.F. Malan, who would become the first nationalist, Afrikaner nationalist prime minister in 1948, started the Die Burger here in Cape Town in about 1915. And Pixley Isaka Sema, who was the convener of what became the African National Congress, also started a newspaper at that time. And when you think of it, those characters and the importance of their papers was profound. Of course, they were having nothing to do with each other, pretty much. Well, that's not strictly true. Gandhi and Sema, we'll come to their relationship a little bit later. But it was also in 1912 that the newspaper press union expelled the existing black member of the newspaper press union and barred blacks from being members. Okay, we're going to go back to the beginning. This is the proclamation of the first South African newspaper on July the 21st, 1800. It's signed by the British governor of the Cape, Sir George Young, without a Young, and it grants a monopoly to the firm of Walker and Robertson. And what it says there, it's a bit difficult to read, is Walker and Robertson will be the sole government printers and the only licensed printers in this colony, and the right to publish a newspaper weekly, and any other person attempting the same will be subject to prosecution, confiscation of their materials, paying for every offence on conviction, a fine of $1,000. So that's the founding of our newspaper industry in South Africa. Robertson and Walker had other businesses, primarily in the slave trade. They were slavers. They had the right to pirate French and Spanish ships on the high seas for their slaves, and at least one of their deals involved a single consignment of 600 slaves. Besides that quote-unquote legitimate business, they also were in shady business deals with the governor himself. Are we still audible? Okay. When the governor was kicked out of government housing, as happens to heads of government from time to time, he moved in with his business partners, Robertson and Walker, and finally returned to England on one of their slave ships, which had been named in its slave trading days the Lady Young, in honor of the governor's wife. So it's hard to think of anything that was not corrupt about the birth of my profession in South Africa.
Completely
gone. Is that better?
Yes.
Coming and going. Okay, thanks. We're waiting for the handheld mic. So, what I was really saying, it should have been followable, but it's hard to think of anything that was not corrupt in the founding of my profession in South Africa. But just to put it in context, and while we're waiting for a little better equipment, you know, this was the same time that in America, Thomas Jefferson, the great thinker and architect and inventor and innovator, was making the statement, "Were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to choose the latter." So journalists love Jefferson for saying that, but I'm afraid his practice wasn't the same as that statement. And in any event, he also said a whole lot of contradictory things. For example, are we still audible? If I hold it up, is that better? No, it's really coming and going. There's not much I can do till they. Okay, they're looking for a microphone. So Jefferson also said, maybe if I stand a bit closer. Jefferson also said, "The man who reads nothing at all is better educated than the man who reads nothing but newspapers." So he was a man of some contradictions. He also paid a muckraker to rake muck in the press about his enemies, and his enemies did the same to him with the same muckraker. They paid the same journalist to write the story that he was having an affair with his slave, Sally Hemings. So the practice was not exactly as the theory was even then, but that was the debate going on there, at least. And in fact, the American press at that time was a mixture of terrible muckraking, prejudiced, inaccurate and biased stuff, and some quite important serious writing, including the Federalist Papers, which were really the founding thinking around the Constitution. Now, after Walker and Robertson were after the governor left the... Is that better? Oh, the fixed mic.
Yes.
This one.
Yes.
Where's the fixed mic? There isn't one. It's an illusion of mic. It's virtual. Where were we? So after the governor left the castle and Walker and Robertson lost their paper, it was brought in to be government run, other presses began, including by missionaries, especially by missionaries, and they had varying politics. Some were loyal to the white settlers, some were loyal to Britons, or varying degrees of loyalty to Britain, the white settlers, and also some to opposing slavery and supporting the condition, the circumstances of black South Africans. The most important, of course, was started by two other Scots, Thomas Pringle and John Fairbairn, who really fought the first important battle for press freedom against Lord George Somerset. And they were working with Reverend John Philip, the of the London Missionary Society. So they were quite clearly abolitionists. And although they fought on the side of settler interests against the British authorities at times, but they were also politically very concerned about the conditions of black South Africans. And in fact, Pringle, when he returned to Britain, went to work with Wilberforce, the anti-slavery campaign until the successful achievement of abolition. The other thing. In 1929, they finally got a proclamation of press of a free press in South Africa, and the monopoly that Sir George Young had established was formally revoked. It was a press victory, but in response, a strong pro-settler press began and became almost a bubble. Between 1842 and 1898, 17 papers that were started survived less than a year, a bit reminiscent of our internet bubble. Very small towns had newspapers, because it was the only method of communication. The growth continued. There were four in Cape Town by 1826, 20 years later. Most towns had one by the end of the 19th century. And the Star started, it was moved to Johannesburg only 3 years after the founding of Johannesburg, 1889. It's quite extraordinary how quickly that happened. Cecil Rhodes, this brings us to another tradition which has been continued right to the present year. Cecil Rhodes funded several of these newspapers. And of course, what that meant was when he didn't like them, he could fire the editor. And that happened with one of the greatest newspapermen in South African history, someone called Francis Dormer, who put the Argus together with the Star and started to build a modern early 20th century newspaper sector. But in fact, he fell out with Rhodes because he had some sympathy for the Boers in the leading up to the Anglo-Boer War. And in fact, he was fired in 1895 by Rhodes, beginning a tradition which has been assiduously maintained by subsequent publishers in South Africa, some of whom you've seen reported very recently. Now I want to go to Solomon Blaikie very briefly. He was perhaps the most one of the most important of the early founding fathers of South Africa, but his role in newspapers was considerable. He started and part-owned and edited two newspapers in two different towns, one in Mafeking and one in Kimberley. And then, of course, as many of you will know, he was absolutely extraordinary man. He wrote two books of non-fiction, The Boer War Diary of Sol Plaikie and Native Life in South Africa. Authored the first black South African novel, Moody, and translated Shakespeare plays into Setswana. So he was one of the editors of that time, and I want to go back to Jabavu, because John Tengo Jabavu started a paper in King Williamstown, which in 1901 was closed by the British for pro-Boer sympathies. In fact, he saw no good coming from this white man's war for the future of black people, and of course he was right. But his paper was kept closed for the duration of the war by the British and reopened in October 1902. Now, I'm now going to talk a little bit about Gandhi's paper, which started in 1903. By this stage, Gandhi was in Johannesburg, and again, Johannesburg was, 17 years old, and he was a lawyer there, although his paper was run from Durban, printed in Durban, and then he moved the printing press to Phoenix, the settlement outside Durban. But he wrote most of it from Johannesburg at that time, but his editor most of the time was this man, Henry Pollock, who was a very close supporter of his, and someone whom he sent to India to lobby for the cause of Transvaal Indians. At this time, of course, Gandhi was a loyal British subject who had only just disbanded his British Indian Ambulance Corps that he'd run during the Anglo-Boer War. What is extraordinary about Indian opinion, let's see if we can, that's his friend Kallenbach, and that was his secretary, Sonia Schlesen, who he articled as a lawyer. She was the first woman woman lawyer in South Africa, and it was to Gandhi. So this is a couple of random examples of the paper. What is really important about it is that he used it, it was really one of the first examples of using the diaspora. He made this paper relevant on three continents. Copies went to London and to India, as well as, of course, South Africa, every edition, and he used it to lobby the British on behalf of particularly the Transvaal Indians, and to develop his theories of Satyagraha, civil disobedience. He was also in communication with Tolstoy, who was on the right, who was, that's not a very typical picture of Tolstoy, but I believe it is Tolstoy, who was at that time considered perhaps the most important novelist in the world. And he was in extensive correspondence with him and published work from him, and also Olive Schreiner, as you see on the left. So he was publishing widely, also publishing material from the black press, and the black press were publishing some of his Indian opinion stuff in the black South African press. So it was an extraordinarily interesting time of ferment, and he developed his ideas of civil disobedience and taught people how to use it. And then in 1907, for the first time, he ran a headline in Indian Opinion, which unfortunately I don't have here, which said, "To the jail." And he called on Transvaal Indians to go to jail, to not resist, to maintain dignity, ask for more severe sentences, refuse bail, etc. And in that sense was very important. And it's really quite an astonishing story. And by the way, there's a new book. If any of you are interested in this, I'd really recommend it. It's Gandhi Before India by someone called G-U-H-A. It's just come out. And he's had access to South African and other archives that's never been seen before. And the point he makes is that there was something like 10,000 Indians in the Transvaal, and yet he turned it into a cause célèbre around the world. The British Viceroy in India got involved because obviously he was very concerned that this treatment of British subjects, Indian British subjects, in South Africa could damage relations between the British and the Indians in India. and it was actually his campaign in the Transvaal with a tiny number of South African Indians, Transvaal Indians, that led to the coverage he gave it through Indian Opinion, that led to his reputation being so high that when he went back to India, he was already starting to be called the Mahatma and treated as someone who was of great importance to the Indian nationalist movement. He left South Africa in 1914. After a successful campaign of civil disobedience, which actually led to the abolition of the Indian poll tax, which had been the main subject of his fight. But at that point, his second son, Manilal, after Pollock was editor, Manilal Gandhi became editor. And I have a book here which you can find on the remainder shelves all over Cape Town called Manilal Gandhi's Prisoner? And it really talks about how Gandhi was kind to everybody else's children but his own, and Manilal was in some senses really a prisoner of his father. He stayed in Phoenix the rest of his life. He ran the paper to 1961 or so, loyal to his father, but his father had discouraged him from getting an education. He'd turned away from believing in education, even though he'd had such a good education himself and so on. And it was really an unsatisfactory relationship, but Manilal did keep the paper going for another, 50 years or so. Okay, we're still waiting for a microphone. Which one? This isn't a camera, isn't a microphone.
The problem is the mic. This is the mic jack. It's the only one that works. That you're gonna have to hold it and speak, because it works when you're speaking down. This means up. Okay. When you hear it, it's up.
Okay. So what we want to try it again. Is that working?
Do you have a pocket of it?
No, I don't.
Please give me your pocket.
Okay. Put that in my pocket.
Just to stand in one place.
Ah, okay. All right. I'll try. Okay. Now, the next paper I want to talk about is really extraordinarily important, and again there's a new book out and brought out by the Wits Press called The People's Paper, and this is a picture of the staff of this black South African newspaper around about 1915, and I just thought it's an extraordinary picture because it's really not something we grew up knowing or being told in our history to expect that you'd find in South Africa at that time. And it does enable me to introduce the first woman, because I know we called this the men who changed South African media. And there weren't women in that capacity. Olive Schreiner and others did write. But the one who was really important was this woman on the left, Queen Regent Lobotsibeni. She was the Swazi Queen Regent. She was illiterate, but she was very politically shrewd, and she understood that there was a real danger at that time that Swaziland would be incorporated into South Africa. And she saw all the attendant problems for her people if that happened. And so she raised, not all of the money, but a portion of the £3,000 to start this paper that's referred to there in the first issue. And it was started by the leaders of the ANC, particularly Sembe, the same year that the ANC started. Now, many copies of this book and of this newspaper are no longer in existence. So researchers have been doing really important work in finding what's findable in the different places, putting it together and researching it. So we have some kind of picture. And why this paper is particularly important, not only because it's the ANC's first paper, but because it was, in fact, the first national black paper. It wrote in isiZulu, Sesotho, Setswana, Xhosa, and English. It went right around the country. It had several different editors. In fact, they had different language editors at times, and there were changes of editors. But it really was the early days of testing out ideas. They debated socialism, the role of whites, Christianity, the role of the British, and in a Bantamata. And so it played a really important role. I just have this one poem that I like from that was published in 1920 in Abantubata, which I thought I'd read you. It's called "The White Man and His Native Problem." A white man welcomed me unheed. He stronger grew and crushed me. He hitched me round with countless laws to snare me for his prison jaws, with which he means to solve me. Now, what killed off Abantubata was, in fact, not the government. The government did give it some advertising, and that helped, but the Chamber of Mines funded a rival paper, because this one they regarded as too radical. It was called Umtetele wa Bantu, and that was probably the main reason for its decline, because then, of course, the government had somewhere else to shoot its ads and so on. As I say, I'd really encourage you, any of you interested in this book, People's Paper, is a book of essays, but it's very readable, and if you have an interest in these things, it's really fresh history that's really quite fascinating and quite new to most of us. I'm going to now go to the start of broadcasting in South Africa, which is also, you know, it's one of the many examples of the opportunity South Africa lost. One of my favorite quotes is something I found in the Rand Daily Mail in September of 1928, saying television to start soon on the RAN. In 1929 was the first testing of television in South Africa, here at UCT and then at WITS. Of course, the signals were very bad, and in fact most countries didn't get actual television for a while, because there was the Depression, then there was the war. But by the late 40s, countries were starting to get it, and of course we didn't until 47 years after that headline. But the start was quite propitious. There were experiments with wireless transmission in Port Elizabeth as early as 1898. Ships were using it prior to 1910. Kaiser Wilhelm put a transmitter in Windhoek before the war, the First World War, which Smuts's troops smashed as soon as they got into Windhoek in 1915. And so by 1924, Joburg, Cape Town, and Durban were ready to start radio. And they used three different models. In Johannesburg, many of you will know Sir Sidney Kentridge and his son William. Well, Sidney Kentridge's father, William Kentridge, the artist's grandfather, was Morris Kentridge, and he was a Labour Party member of the Durban City Council. Is this still working?
Yeah.
Sort of.
Sort of.
Is that better? Let me get this right. Well, Kentridge, William's grandfather, Morris Kentridge, was a Labour Party councillor in Johannesburg, and the government weren't too happy about the idea of him having an influence on the new radio station because he was Labour, which meant sort of socialist, even if socialist only for whites. And so they decided to give the license for Johannesburg to an association for scientists, and they started it in Joburg. In Durban, the city council started in Cape Town. Also quite an interesting story. Sir David Croft, grandfather of the current Sir David Croft, was the Minister of Posts and Telegraphs, but he also owned equipment in his own name, and he was approached by the Publicity Association of the Cape Peninsula for the radio license. He got into his car and drove down to the Postmaster General, who was directly reported to him, and said, "Mr. Postmaster General, do I hold the government license for the Cape Broadcasting Station?" The Postmaster General said, "Yes." He said, "Well, then please hand it over to the gentleman of the Publicity Association." And that's how the Cape Town radio began. At that time, by the way, the Cape Town Council didn't want to have anything to do with it because they were losing so much money on the Symphony Orchestra already. Now, all three of these stations didn't run news. They played music and other elevating themes like that, and they funded it through license fees paid to the post office. One paper wrote that the trouble is that people were listening to the radio without paying their radio license fees, like gutter snipes endeavouring to watch a circus under the tent wall. Well, of course, the gutter snipes won, and the papers the radio station closed by about 1927, and were eventually handed over to I.W. Schlesinger, who was a New York-born, Brooklyn-born, Bronx-born New Yorker, who was in various businesses in South Africa. He ran the film houses. He also had a newspaper and some magazines, and he turned it into something effective on business lines. But that only lasted until 1936, because in 1934 the General Herzog, the then Prime Minister, invited the head of the BBC in Britain to come out here and suggest a new way. Okay, so let me take this little. Oh, we're going the other way. That's Durban. That's this was Joburg was on top of the Statifitz building. That was in Durban, that was here in Cape Town at the Green Market Square. And this is Lord Reith. As you see, he's a rather formidable character, the head of the BBC, he was an engineer. That gash on his cheek was about a 4-inch scar from a World War I wound. He was an extraordinary character, but he was someone who believed in putting information in front of the public in a fair and unbiased way. He talked about the dynamic bringing of unrelated persons into relation. In other words, robust news. And he said that pushing one's wares or ideas is misbehavior of irresponsible proprietors or large propaganda organizations, governments included. So, you know, in Britain to this day, when you refer to Reith or Reithian broadcasting, it's referred to with great admiration because it's the idea of the traditions of the BBC of giving all sides a say, not being controlled by commercial instincts, and covering things that are of public interest not rather than just commercial interest. But I have had access to Reith's diary of his time in South Africa. And he did have some rather extraordinary meetings which reveal things about both him and about us South Africans. When he saw Herzog, he told Herzog that I would, that he did not think that giving the franchise, that taking away the franchise from black people was essential to get the country going. So he wasn't a Democrat, but he was open-minded in wanting to use broadcasting to have a positive effect. The other thing that I found most striking in his diary about his time in South Africa was his meeting with the defense minister, Oswald Biro, on whose road many of us drive every day. And Biro told Reith, "I'd like to see something approaching Nazi rule, and would then hope to use broadcasting as an adjunct thereto." Pirot had met all four of the great fascist leaders. He'd met Hitler in Berchtesgaden, he'd met Mussolini, Franco, and Salazar, and incidentally, like, thought Salazar was most intellectually impressive. And Reith noted all of this, but was obviously not fazed by it, and he thought that South Africa was still in safe pro-British hands, and he recommended a BBC-style SABC. That's what happened. But in fact, it was to some degree Pirro's vision as much as Reith's that came to hold sway. And that was done by this man, Dr. Pitt Meyer, who not coincidentally has a Hitler moustache. He named his son Izan, which is Nazi spelled backwards. He was became the head of the Brillebund shortly after becoming head of the SABC in about 1959. And he decided he was going to change the SABC completely, and he did it. His mission was to stop the rot. And at that stage, the nationalists, who'd taken power in 1948, they didn't have anyone to run the SABC, so they put in charge of the SABC someone by the name of Gideon Bruys, who was a lawyer from a prominent Afrikaner family and who they thought would be a safe pair of hands. But in fact, he fell much more in the Reithian model. He was no left-winger, but he did believe in covering things fairly. And so Mayer got rid of him. His job was to get rid of him, and he did indeed get rid of him. Mayer was one of a generation of people who'd studied in Holland in the 30s and developed a theory about a thread of Calvinism, which opened of Dutch Calvinism, which opened the way to an apartheid theology. And this was not something accidental or just a minor implementation of racial segregation. It was really a theory that they could convey to the churches and control the churches. And Mayer was a most extraordinary figure. Within weeks of taking over, he banned a report in the SABC on radio, of course, by Sir Roy Walensky, who was then the Prime Minister of the Federation of Rhodesia and Iceland, because he talked about television. So here was a guy at the head of the SABC who thought it was okay to ban his neighbouring Prime Minister because he disagreed with him. And really there was not much he didn't get his hands into. He had once spoken admiringly of Lenin for saying that the way to get control of organisations is to be secretary. So here was Pitt Meyer, father of Izan, saying that that's the way to do it, and he became the deputy secretary of the Brudebond and dozens of other organizations, and that's how he built his power and eventually became head of the SABC, and shortly after that, head of the Broederbond. He moved the Broederbond offices to right next door to the SABC for convenience. He was involved in just about everything you can imagine. He was on a committee to deal with the Jewish problem. I'm not sure if he felt he'd ever resolved this problem. He organized, while head of the SABC, he organized a People's Congress on the danger of liberalism, which led to communism. He stopped all UN broadcasts on the SABC. One of the things that really struck me was something I read of Gwendolyn Carter, you know, the American historian, who said that even in by the late 50s, she noticed that South Africans' views of the world had changed remarkably even by the late 50s, and that was before Mayer came in with his really aggressive approach. It's changed sport, fired old departments. It wasn't just ideological. You didn't get kicked off just for your views. He stopped all economists from the English universities, UCT, Wits, any of those, could not be on the air. They had to be Afrikaans economists. They could also have an impact on the press by stopping receiving SAPA, you know, that's the National Press Agency, and by cutting off funds, SABC's considerable amount of funds from it, you could do a lot to kill it off. Robert Kennedy came here when he was, of course, he made his famous speech here at UCT, which you'll still see on his grave at Arlington Cemetery across from the Potomac from Washington, D.C. That was never reported on SABC. Robert Kennedy's visit here was unreported, even though he was then one of the most powerful men in the world and a potential president. One presenter read out a greeting to members of the Black Sash and just said, "Well done, girls, keep up the good work." And he never worked again. The whole department, the Durban department of the SABC, resigned. The resignations came on all sides. Hugh Rouse, some of you may remember, was also kicked off. And that was by 1962. So it was a really comprehensive way of changing things. I think I'm going to stop there and take some questions, because I may have gone too far or too slowly. And also check how much you've been able to hear of what I said.
Well, ironic, on the cover of the book that you put on early on, they had a picture of Dr. Foote.
Yes.
And he, of course, was an editor quite standing in Transvaal.
Yes. The question is about Dr. Verwoerd. Well, interestingly enough, Verwoerd and Mayer were very close. When Verwoerd was the first attempted assassination, the first person to see him outside the family was Mayer. I've been in correspondence with a Verwoerd biographer recently who says, well, they weren't friends because Verwoerd didn't have friends. He kept aloof from everybody. But he was probably as close as there was to a friend of Verwoerd. They both had done PhDs in Holland in the 30s. They'd both done some studying in Germany. There's some dispute about whether Verwoerd's, exactly what German his role was in Germany in the 30s. But Mayer led a delegation in the 30s to Nazi Germany. He met with, befriended Rudolf Hess while he was chief of staff to Hitler. Hess took him skiing, so his ski instructor was Rudolf Hess. They became close. And he was a founder of the Afrikaner Studentenbond. And the purpose of his main delegation there was to form official ties with the Hitler Youth and the National Socialist Youth League. So, you know, most Afrikaner nationalists were sympathetic to the Germans over World War II, but that didn't make them Nazis, and I really think one has to be careful not to exaggerate that. But this one, I think there's so much evidence that he was more than just someone who wanted Britain to be defeated in 1945.
Looking at a lot of the views that you're putting out now, which are totally factual, I think a lot of that particular time was a swing back against the enormously strong English influence that you had in South Africa at the time. Something we hear about but gets buried is that there was a British plan in 1937 to ship 1 million Polish Jews to South Africa. And apparently it got fairly far advanced and then quietly disappeared. Now, that must have shown enormous influence of the British government at the time and British thinking. And, you know, loyalty to the crown. So a lot of this in the Afrikaners, let's face it, lost out in the Boer War, weren't forgetting about it. They were getting their own back.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I you know, there's always the change of the...
What's the question?
What is the question?
The question is basically, isn't a lot of what was going on there, the Afrikaners getting their own back on the hugely strong English influence that you had before them?
Yes, I think that's true. You know, but there's a whole
question, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. The question is, wasn't it just the English getting the Afrikaners getting their own back on the British because of the way the English treated them? And he's also saying that there was a plan to get, a million Polish Jews. There was a British plan to get 1 million Polish Jews to South Africa. I'm not quite sure how that fits. I'd be interested to know the history of that, but. But I'm not quite sure how that fits with it. But certainly the British, from Milner's day, wanted to anglicise South Africa. There's no question of it. And they were excessively cruel to the Boers in the Anglo-Boer War. And then the Nationalists were excessively cruel to blacks in South Africa afterwards.
Who was Mandela's secret friend?
Tomorrow.
Well, we have some tomorrow.
Sorry, it's out of my hands.
Sorry, that's why I'm here. I'm here to apologize. Apparently, we're having problems here, big problems with the microphone. So to all of you, and also particularly to the speaker, I'm very sorry. We have spoken to the classroom services, and they will come in between this lecture and the next one and fix it. And tomorrow we'll have a good old-fashioned... I'm terribly sorry.
Now we know what it's like to be President Obama when all the technology fails.
Yeah, that's not supposed to, so I'm terribly sorry. So somebody said to me, we're the guinea pigs, clearly. But they will come in tomorrow.
Yeah.
The plan to send 1 million Polish Jews to South Africa might indicate some sympathy rather than opposition to the Jews, not only in view of what happened later, but also in view of the kinder transport, the fact that many people got out one way or another and were assisted.
Of course, I don't know anything about that story. It could have had several motivations. Yeah.
Is there information available on Francis Dormer, who was about to manage your... Is there some information I'd like to read about him?
The book I'm using for that is by Wessel de Kock. It's called In a Manner of Speaking. It's out of print, but I have a copy, and we could talk afterwards about it. It's interesting because we will get into some of this tomorrow. How Laurie Gann, it was by the Daily Mail, please views. Raymond was fired as the editor of the Rancho for his views. And there really is a parallel right back to Francis Dormer, who was considered probably the most impressive media person of his day, because he wasn't just a good editor. He put the group together, and he was very good commercially as well. He was good at a lot of different things, and he really was a founder of the newspaper press union, I believe, as well. So he was a very impressive figure, and it was rather tragic that, as has happened so many times, our best people, I would argue, well, I'll talk about it tomorrow, but on the Rand Daily Mail, we really had one or two people who were quite exceptional. Max had, I mean, a lot of people were fired for being good journalists.
Yeah,
but Dormer was the first of real major stature, really.
How did the editor of the Cape Times manage to face down Rhodes? I read the other day. If he also got in trouble, apparently he faced down Rhodes. Do you know anything about this?
No, I can't tell you offhand how I did that.
What does that mean?
It's intention.
No, I can't tell you. What I'm trying to do is to tell as much as possible stories that, you know, go into areas that you haven't heard much about. And so I haven't focused on that. And I focused more on the Joburg papers generally, because the Mail and the Sunday Times, as you'll see tomorrow, really drove the process and in the end driven out because of it. perhaps we should. Sorry, Ken.
I was just wondering if you could say something more about Francis Dormer's sympathy for the Boers, because sympathy for the Boers actually could mean several different things in that context. I mean, you know, there were people who were sympathetic to the Boers, but nonetheless went along with Rhodes, like Sir Graham Bower, for example.
Yes.
And there were people who were sympathetic to the Boers and resisted Rhodes.
Yes.
Openly, and people who dragged their feet.
Yes. Well, I mean, Rhodes had good relations with the Dutch Afrikaner political leadership until that point.
Yes.
And around about the time of the Jameson raid, people like Dormer, or just before, Dormer fell out with him because they felt the British policy was intending to drive towards war, to take over the Transvaal and the Free State, and many of them there. And it, as you know, one of the things I found interesting, because it actually relates to my family as well, there were people at the turn of the century, the liberal position in Europe, in Britain as well as in the Scandinavian countries, was to oppose the British, because this was a patriotic war, an anti-colonial war. And I think Dormer's view was simply that the British were giving an unfair deal to the Afrikaner. I think if there are no more questions, we should probably end the torture of this microphone system. And tomorrow I will talk about Mandela's secret friend and how he took on Mayer, which was really one of the really big battles of ideas that's come to what I've been working on. Thank you.
Do you want to switch this off, or do you get off your...
I'm going to shut
down. Okay. Play that, thank you. Yes.
He was putting down the phone as a joke to the message
around between
the commission's
office and the department.
Oh, that's
funny. How did he one time you was? No. Well, of course, he was never admitted as well.
That's not
my thing.
It doesn't give me an option of
watching. Shut down.
No. It's a leader.